You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a WPR reporter takes us to a community-built ice castle that recently opened in Eagle River. Now the spike in COVID-19 cases is leading to a big demand for testing. And in many cases, those tests are hard to come by. So new websites are showing up, and testing sites conducted out of tents and vans have been popping up in cities around the country. Some of them are run by private companies and are perfectly legit. Others, not so much. So you've got to take some caution. Jim Temer is president and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. How are you, Rob?
Pretty good. Well, before we get to these scams, Jim, we don't want to discourage people from getting tested. There are a lot of legitimate options out there, right?
Oh, you bet they are. And the best thing and the bottom line is make sure you're going to an authorized test site or health centers. You can visit your local health department if that's the county or the state, tribal, your own healthcare system. You know, give them a call. They may not be able to take you right away, but they might be able to direct you to the correct place. And we just heard, you know, hopefully that the peak is past for this, but we know that as long as COVID's going on, there are going to be scammers trying to take advantage of us. So we want to take care of ourselves. We want to take care of our health and take care of our wallets.
All right, now let's get to the scams. What kind of things are we seeing out there?
Well, there's two variations of this scam, really online and in person. And the online scam is you may get a text or an email or even a phone message directing you to a website where you can make an appointment to go in and get tested. So they ask for your personal information, your insurance, your medical information, maybe a credit card because they say there's a small processing fee. So on the day of the appointment, you go where they told you to go. It might be a well-known pharmacy. It might be a healthcare location, and they have no record of it. It was just someone out there phishing, trying to get your personal information, credit card, insurance, anything that they can about you. And you're out of luck because you gave them that. Who knows what they're going to do with it down the line? It's not going to be anything good, and you don't get a test. The other thing we're finding are some of these pop-up sites. And you're right, not all of them are scams. Not all of them are phony, but we just tell people, please be aware and have a grain of salt. We've had reports that you'll make an appointment or you'll just walk in and they'll take a swab and they'll ask again for all sorts of personal information. And the next thing you know, they'll say, well, we'll get back to you in 24 hours. And we've had people say it's been 2-3 weeks and they haven't received any results. And the company is still there. The business is still there doing COVID tests. So will they ever get results? Is this personal information being safeguarded? Is it being used correctly? Or is it a big scam?
So what are some of the red flags of the kind of information they're asking for us to get that test that I think in most cases is supposed to be free, right?
Right. It's free. You should just be able to walk in. Now, you have to be leery, you know, if they're asking for, right, they may say, well, there's some processing fee. There shouldn't be. If they ask for any kind of payment, any kind of credit card to hold something, even if nothing will be charged, it's a red flag. You know, they don't need to have your social security number. Do they need your address? Maybe, but you can ask what they're doing with that information. Also, kind of be aware if you walk into a place and you notice the staff isn't, you know, gowned and masked up properly, another red flag. If it doesn't appear to be a healthcare facility and you know what they're like, you know, these places are clean. They try their best. Our healthcare workers are usually gowned and masked or, so you have to look out for what you're doing. Now, we understand the public demand for these tests is high, and there are tests more available now than, say, the last few weeks. But again, scammers through this whole pandemic have been taking advantage of people because they play off of our emotion. So when you're worried, you're upset, you don't know what's going on, you want that test so bad, boy, you will pay for it, or you will go anywhere for it. And when people start acting emotionally instead of thinking logically, that's when they get ripped off.
I want to go back online with you now. Scammers are pretty good at making their website look like it might be an official website. One case in point, you know, there is a legit U.S. Postal Service thing where you can go get some free COVID tests mailed to you. Apparently, there are some scams where you get, again, that text or email or whatever that refers you to a site. They've spoofed the USPS logo. How do we figure out that that's not the real deal?
Yep. Well, first of all, it's odd that, the Postal Service or most healthcare organizations, without your knowledge or approval, will not be sending you texts or emails telling you to do stuff. So if you get something out of the blue from someone that you aren't associated with, that also is a red flag. And when you go visit a website, if it's USPS, the United States Post Office, anything governmental will end in .gov. If it ends in .com, it's not officially government. Healthcare things, those will end in .com, but you want to make sure they're spelled right and they're secure. When you look up in the URL, the address line, for it to be secure, there's either going to be a little padlock logo or it will start with HTTPS, and that S means secure. So if you put any personal information in there, it will be, it will be secure. Also, these pop-up websites, one problem are they're so hard to hunt down, and this goes for all e-commerce, is a website will come up for 2 weeks, it'll go down, it'll come up with a slightly different name, it'll come down, it'll come up somewhere else. So all the information that has gone in there, you can't follow up on it. If you're, you know, looking at things, you want to look at the About Us section. You know, do they have anything in there? Do they have a physical location? Do they have people you can actually contact on the phone if you have problems? Remember, this is something where not only you're going to not get the health information you need, but when you're giving out all your personal information, you're setting yourself up for identity theft and who knows how much money you could lose.
If we encounter a site, either a website or one of these pop-up sites, and we think, wow, this doesn't look legit to me, A, obviously don't give them your information, but B, where can we report this kind of thing?
Well, we are collecting that information at the BBB. I go to BBB, you can go on our scam tracker, you can report it. You can just give us a call or an email and report it. And we share that with law enforcement agencies. Now, this is so new. Again, this has only been going on for the past, not even month, just a couple of weeks, that we've been working across the country. We got BBBs all over and compiling all our information. And actually, we're finding a lot of these places are tied together and they're operating out of Chicago. Now, we're just beginning this investigation stage. And as I said, we share this with the Federal Trade Commission, FBI, anyone else. So if you do have a problem, you do think that you've been scammed, or you stopped because it was a potential scam, let us know. All that information, or if you get a text or a phone call, the phone numbers, even though that stuff changes, anything we can get is beneficial. It's kind of a crowdsourcing way for us to defeat these scammers.
Jim, thanks for joining us again.
Always my pleasure. Stay warm.
You too. That's Jim Temer, President and CEO at the Better Business Bureau serving Wisconsin. We talked to him about a rise of fake COVID-19 testing operations. We've got some tips on how to avoid being scammed. Find them at WPR.org/Central Time. This week, WPR is featuring stories of how the pandemic has been felt by all of us. On today's Wisconsin Life, producer Maureen McCollum brings us a poem about losing a loved one to COVID-19.
Pam Gustafson of Milwaukee loves to write poetry. It helps her process everything she reads and sees in her life.
I call it therapy, you know, because physically I am unable to cry due to an autoimmune disorder.
So when Gustafson's sister, Mary Beth Nolan, died from COVID complications last May, she couldn't cry about it. To grieve, Gustafson wrote a poem.
After her death, I went through a period where I was quite angry because there were so many people who refused to vaccinate. So that's when I wrote, "Dying from COVID is not pretty." It channeled my anger over my sister's horrible death.
Her sister was vaccinated, but she was immunocompromised. Gustafson sent her poem to us through WPR's Wisconsin Project with hopes more people could learn about her sister's experience.
Dying from COVID is not pretty. Dying from COVID is not gentle death. It is a brutal way to die, gasping for breath. I watched my baby sister die this way. She begged for a ventilator every day. She knew a ventilator signaled the end. But her fear and anxiety needed to mend. I saw fear in her eyes and tried to send messages of love to my sister, my friend. Her long hair was matted against her face. Her teeth were black with lots of dried gunk. She had to communicate by trying to write, refused to move her mask, aware of her plight. Imagine gasping for air just to talk. So much fatigue, you cannot walk. Like choking on a piece of food blocking air, or drowning your gasping lungs in despair. And living for weeks on tubes alone, what your body used to do on its own, A catheter to pee, you can't walk to the can. Tired, you can't lift your body for a bedpan. A tube that brings you some nourishment. Your body can't coordinate breath and eating. Now your lungs are deflated, balloons pleading for the air they were used to and needing. Two garden hoses sutured to your neck to remove carbon dioxide waste, to replenish oxygen, organs to baste. You can't move, there is no food to taste. Imagine writing a note to your sister. This is the last time you will see me. Even though it hadn't crossed my mind, the sight of her struggle was so unkind. She was right. It was the last time. But at that point, I still had hope. But my sister just could not cope, her lungs functioning at 0%. Doctors considered double lung transplant, but my sister wanted to end the struggle. She was constantly thinking, I just can't. I have been short of air for a long month. And on that same note, she wrote to me, was a note to the people who gave her care. Can you put me under, insert the tube? She was suffering, wanted to die, I conclude. For death was her only choice to end her pain. Then her kidneys shut down, her heart waned. They brought her back twice, but it was her will to escape her body, the one that COVID killed.
Pam Gustafson of Milwaukee shares a poem she wrote about her sister, Mary Beth Nolan, who died from COVID-19 complications. Gustafson read that poem at her sister's funeral. Nolan was 59, an educator, a wife, a mother of three, and a grandmother. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from other Wisconsinites about how they've been affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. There's more to come here on Central Time. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's really cold around Wisconsin right now, but one winter tradition is back to give us a reason to go outside. Ice castles. There's one open to visitors in Lake Geneva, and another community-built ice castle is open in Eagle River. Rob Mentzer recently paid the Eagle River Ice Castle a visit. He's WPR's Rural Communities reporter based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
Well, good. Paint us a radio picture, Rob, of the ice castle you saw in Eagle River.
Sure. Well, it's a beaut. It's especially beautiful at night. It is built out of more than 2,000 of these like giant blocks of ice that they harvest out of Silver Lake, and there's a spire in the center that's like 33 feet tall. It's these 10 feet tall walls of ice, and they have it lit up from within at night, and it's right downtown Eagle River, and people come and take photos.
They would do it every year, I think, if they could, but there's some pretty tight parameters, I understand, Rob. What has to work out just right for them to be able to do this?
Right. There's really a tight window. So Eagle River is a snowmobiling capital, as a lot of people know. That's probably what it's maybe best known for, is a place people come from all over the place to go to snowmobile in that area in Vilas County. And every January, they have a world snowmobile tournament that brings thousands of people to town. And that happens in mid-January. And so the goal for the ice castle, that which is built by the fire department and community volunteers, is to have it constructed by the time of that snowmobile tournament, right? So in order to do that, the ice on the lake needs to be at least 12 inches thick by around the new year, and not more than 16 inches thick. So there's like a window in there. I asked also if they what about these snowmobilers? Why don't you could build it? You could still build it in January. And the chief there said that the other thing is that the sun starts to get too powerful by this. You know, if you wait too long, he said 1 year they built it and it lasted for 4 days. so that's not what you want out of your for your ice castle.
And this is the first time with those tight conditions, first time it's happened since 2018. How often do they actually get to pull this thing off, given those conditions you just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, it is not every year thing at all, right? 2018 was the last one. I think that's sort of what the rotation is. It's every few years, as opposed to every year. And of course, that does have the effect of it does make it like kind of special. People, the fact that this is an ice castle year gets people's attention, has people like me write stories about it, and you know, a bunch of local news stories will talk about it. And so even people I talked to when I was up there, they said, yeah, you know, we wanted to get up here because this is not a you know, we don't know when the next time you'll be able to see it is.
And there are some for-profit ice castles that happen elsewhere around the country. This is, as you mentioned, a community effort. When you talk to people up there, was there that sense of community pride? Like, yeah, we get together and build this thing?
Right, for sure. So primarily it is a function of the fire department, but they do have their people, you know, just people who pitch in. But even the fire department is a volunteer fire department. So most of those people are volunteering already, their time and energy. It has such a fun history in Eagle River that the town first built an ice castle in 1933. And, there were for a long time in the history of it, there was an ice company. You know, it used to be a business that you could have in Wisconsin, is selling blocks of ice for people's ice boxes. And the C.H. Hanke Ice Company sold the blocks of ice or provided the blocks of ice for the Eagle River Ice Castle. And that guy, Charles Hanke, was the fire chief back in the like 40s and 50s in Eagle River. In the late 80s, it was taken over by the fire department again. Some other organizations have been doing it, by the grandson of Charles Hanke, and who carried it on. His name was Jack Thomas, and now it's done by the current fire chief there. So there's really this kind of like fun community history to it as well.
Talking to Rob Mentzer, WPR reporter, about the Eagle River Ice Castle. It is back this year, first time since 2018. Looking at pictures on this cool website the hipsters are all talking about, Rob, at WPR.org. But something that strikes me is the purple lights, the purple lighting on the ice castle, and that has a significance. Can you tell us about it?
Right. So in Eagle River, a 10-year-old girl named Berkeley Adamovich died in December from a rare cancer, and she had been battling that cancer for over a year. And it was really the community had rallied around her family. One of her parents worked for the county there, and it's a small community. People know each other in Eagle River and in the Northwoods area, and so purple ribbons had become a way of showing support for Berkeley and for her family. So the purple light, which really is pretty, I mean, it really looks nice, mm-hmm. is a nod to and a way of honoring Berkeley.
Now, you mentioned this doesn't last too long once the sun starts shining brighter, Rob. How long is this expected to stay up and open?
Boy, it is hard to say. I don't think that it's likely to have melted much today, for instance.
I guess not, probably, yeah.
So it definitely depends a lot on the sun, but I mean, I think we're talking about weeks, not months, you know what I mean? I think that it starts to, and I'm sort of interested. To me, if I lived closer, I would like to see it sort of like half melted, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that'd be kind of fun too. But yeah, I think in its current form, I think that by mid-February, it's going to start to show signs of wear.
Now, it's a cold day today. I don't know how warm it was when you went to see it, Rob. I mean, do you feel like the coldness kind of radiating off of this thing?
Yeah, it's cold, and there's like you can't really go in it, but there's like places to sit. And I was like, no, thank you. I don't sit inside these blocks of ice. But people take photos, And they have trees around it and stuff. So it's cold, but I mean, it's Eagle River. It's already cold. People are cruising in on their snowmobiles and parking, you know, and you know, but they're like fully decked out, right? When you have your full bodysuit and eye protection and everything, you know, it's not so cold to you.
Now you're back in Wausau, Rob. What do you think? Could your community borrow this idea? Do you want it? Can we expect Wausau ice castles under your?
I think we could get it.
And you could be the king of the ice castle.
Well, now that appeals to me. There's an idea. I think we could get an ice castle. I think everybody should do it. Why not? What's stopping you? Everybody should make ice castles.
Maybe not the right amount of ice. Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
All right, thank you.
That's WPR's Rural Communities reporter Rob Mentzer with us today to talk about a community-built ice castle he visited in Eagle River. There's also a fee to see one in Lake Geneva. If you have pictures of an ice castle this year's or from ones in the past, or if you've worked to help build that one in Eagle River, love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, check out Rob's reporting, comment while you're there over at WPR.org, and check out those cool pictures. It really does look cool with those purple lights going on there. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, find out what Wisconsinites think about some big national issues, including the U.S. Supreme Court, with a new opening on the bench. That'll be part of our conversation. Share your thoughts, too. It's the new Marquette University Law School survey. We'll be talking more about the Supreme Court opening on the way with the announced retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer. We'll talk about that on the show on Friday. Plus, should he stay or should he go? After a playoff loss and a year of controversy, Packers fans are wondering about the future of Aaron Rodgers and the Packers. We'll check out the story, what people are thinking, and you can join in with your thoughts. What do you want to see happen? That and more, it's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we check in on recent worker strikes and the state of organized labor across the country. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after an appeals court decision, it looks like there will be ballot drop boxes in use for the upcoming February election, pending another legal challenge. We sort out the latest on how voting is going to go. First, the past year of the pandemic has seen an uptick in labor shortages, people changing jobs, and workers going on strike. Recent work stoppages at John Deere and Kellogg, for example, produced new contracts for their union employees. Labor union membership overall continues to decline across the U.S., but workers at major corporations like Starbucks and Amazon are pushing for new collective bargaining rights. We're exploring where the organized labor movement stands entering 2022, what role the pandemic may be playing, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a union employee, or did you used to be? How do you feel about the strength of your union in 2022? If not, how do you feel about labor unions in general? Do you prefer at-will employment instead? How about right-to-work laws, as we have here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kate Bronfenbrenner is a senior lecturer and director of labor education research at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics shows just 10% of the workforce are members of labor unions. Can you start us off by just telling us about the long-term trends when it comes to labor union membership in the country?
Well, labor movement membership has been in decline in terms of density, but we've seen that surveys have shown that more than nearly 50% of workers today, unorganized workers, would join a union if they could. The reason that they aren't, they say, is that they fear the opposition from employers. We know from research I've done for more than 30 years that when workers try to organize, employers in the private sector aggressively oppose unions through threats, illegal discharges, intimidation, coercion. And that's the reason that workers are afraid to organize. And we see that public support for unions is the highest it's been in 60 years. More than 68% of workers, of the public support unions right now. And we see that in the support for strikes, the public support for strikes. And workers are, the public is supporting organizing and strikes when it happens.
We see some high-profile strikes in the news lately. Are we seeing more of them than we have in recent years?
Yes, the U.S. government under Reagan stopped counting strikes when fewer than 1,000 workers were in the workplace. And we know that most workplaces have fewer than 1,000 workers. So Cornell University started a strike tracker. And we started tracking strikes, and we found that strikes have grown up, have increased dramatically in the last year. The media has noticed that too. We've seen a lot of big strikes, but also small strikes across the country. Workers are angry. We've seen two trends happening in the country. Workers are either quitting, or they're resisting. They're going on strike, and it's not a surprise because they watched in the pandemic as, while they were working harder and sacrificing and taking risks, they saw corporations were making money and exploiting the pandemic to their own advantage. And workers were fed up. They weren't willing to risk their lives and their families' lives for corporations to take advantage.
I wanted to talk more about the impact of the pandemic. You were just saying that partly is driving some workers to be interested in either unionizing or leaving their workplace. Has it made organizing a challenge in some ways, though? The same restrictions that make a workplace hazardous might make a workplace-related meeting equally hazardous.
Unions have had to become very creative. They're learning to use digital organizing. They're having to teach workers how to organize themselves. Union organizers are very creative and people, and the workers themselves are, as you notice, have been going out there and organizing.
I think people, if they think of a union, they might think of a factory, an industrial work site. There's a lot more to unions than that. Can you talk about who tends to be most likely to be unionized these days?
Well, it's interesting. All very different people are organizing. Museum workers, coffee, baristas, delivery drivers, food service workers, grocery workers, every possible occupation are turning to unions. But the majority of new workers organizing today are women of color, immigrant workers. Those are the workers who are most successful at organizing. But we also see professional workers, nurses, teachers, really every classification. The workers who are, interestingly enough, have been least likely to organize today have been, the traditional workers in manufacturing, because they face the threat of plant closings, which often scares them from organizing. That threat that if you organize, the work is going to move overseas is a very effective threat. What I find from my research is employers make that threat, but they don't necessarily follow through. But that threat really scares workers.
Talking about the current state of labor and organized labor in the United States, Kate Bronfenbrenner is with us from Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
I'm very happy to hear this topic because my history goes back to 2010 with a recall and when the unions in Wisconsin were really just gutted. But I retired after 50 years, 25 years in private industry where I was treated fairly or negotiated for fair treatment, 25 years in public service, and when I got to that position, we had immense responsibility and the money wasn't there and the benefits weren't there. So I put together an offer to the school board at a public meeting and said, this is why we deserve this, because I had no union experience. Their response was no, and again, no. And my recourse was, well, I guess I have to start a union here. So we did that, went through mediation, got our contract approved by an arbitrator. I left that job, burned out after 5 years, but my legacy was that union. And what I discovered about unions, people were saying, the union protects the lazy. The union protects the people who don't do it. And my observation was the administrators and the supervisors did not do their jobs to document why that person should be fired.
Vivian, thanks for the call. Kate, Vivian, a long history there with unions, including starting one. But do you have thoughts on what she said about who unions protect and the sort of what goes into firing somebody in a unionized workforce?
Well, it's not as easy to fire someone as people think, but our laws are very clear that, that we have collective bargaining and we have contracts and there is, you know, employers can only fire in a union contract, employers can fire with just cause. And if there's just cause, the employer can fire someone and the union can only protect someone if there is not just cause. If the employer is not a good manager, and then Victoria's right. If there's not good management, then they won't have done their job. You know, a good union is focused on representing their members' interests. They're not focused on protecting bad employees. Because then workers wouldn't want them.
Thanks for the call. We're talking about labor unions during the pandemic with Kate Bronfenbrenner, Director of Labor Education Research at Cornell University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever thought about forming a labor union in your workplace? Why or why not? Are you happy with where you work? Do you feel like your rights as a worker are being respected, whether you're in a union or not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Kate Bronfenbrenner, Cornell University's Director of Labor Education Research, with us today looking at how the pandemic has affected labor unions in the United States. You can join in with your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Madison. Jim, hi.
Hello?
Jim, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I work in post-secondary education, and I basically have had nothing but pay cuts ever since Act 10 came down. I took like an immediate 8% pay cut when it came down, and then I took a 30% pay cut, and I haven't even had a cost of living raise for the last 10 years, and I'm likely to not see one in the foreseeable future. And we still have a union, but we don't have a union contract. And I really appreciated my union. I wish we could have it back, but I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
Jim, thanks for that call. Jim, referring to Wisconsin's Act 10 law, which drastically reduced the power of public employee unions, as he was talking about there. Kate, what kind of trends have you seen when it comes to state laws for public and private employee unions?
Well, I think that we are in a different time than when Act 10. We saw the teacher strikes across the country just in the time just before the pandemic, and I think we may be in I would give some hope to Jim that we may be in a period where there might be a revival of the teachers' unions in Wisconsin again. I wouldn't give up hope that he and his fellow teachers and in the state could come back and build a movement to bring the unions back in Wisconsin. I think people are fighting back. They're frustrated. They know the difference that it made to have collective bargaining for teachers. You saw what happened in the red states in the Southeast and the Southwest. And if they could do it there, you can do it in Wisconsin.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Dale next in Milwaukee. Dale, hi.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was going to write the professor, but thank you for taking my call. I have three quick comments. I'm in my mid-60s. I worked at a large company in Milwaukee. I won't name it, but I had thousands of employees. I was both an hourly worker and union and a manager. Wonderful experiences, with the exception of maybe a few hiccups here and there, but wonderful respect. This was back in the 70s, in the 80s, in the 90s. Absolutely respect from both sides. The second term is the term that the professor probably certainly knows, is seniority. I tell people the best benefit of the union is seniority. So if you're a driver or a person working at as a barista, whatever, and you've been there 3 years, you have a little more choice for your job assignments than someone who's just started. And the third point, and then I'll hang up, is, am I wrong, but I heard not too long ago that Congress, this country, and the Senate of this country are seniority-based. Whoever is the most senior gets the committee assignments, and the most junior really doesn't. So, okay, Dale, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Though there, you can get fired every couple few years if you're in Congress. But, Dale, thanks for the call. Dale's main point, though, of course, about things like seniority benefits for union members, Kate.
Yeah, one of the things that reasons that workers organize is that in a non-union environment, the arbitrariness of decisions. Workers are at the whim of a supervisor or a manager who can, pick and choose by favoritism who gets to do what, and a wage structure or overtime or anything that there's lack of fairness. And when you look at the primary reason workers organize, they organize because they want decisions to be made based on some kind of schedule and fairness and the end to arbitrary decision-making. And seniority is one of the ways that you get rid of arbitrary decision-making. If you say that, okay, we're going to do overtime based on seniority, or we're going to do a wage schedule based on seniority, or to rotate things through seniority, it's a way that you get rid of favoritism. And that's one of the ways that you get rid of it. And that's why workers organize.
Thanks for that call. We'll go time for one more caller. Pat joins us now in Northern Wisconsin. Pat, hello.
Hello.
Oh, what'd you want to tell us about, Pat?
Well, I've been a 37-year union member and a trade union, and I've never had the security of seniority on that positions that I worked in the trade unions. We've always been under the assumption we perform and do our job, and we hold our position by our performance and the work that we produce and the quality of our work. And that seems to be confused with some of the other unions that are out there with their seniority and their protection of the workers' rights. And the trade unions that I worked in, you had no seniority and you had no right to hold your job, but for the quality of your work and the amount of your work, and you could be fired or relieved of your job at any time.
Pat, were there workplace protections that came along from the union or any kind of protections?
Well, we've benefited by negotiating our medical benefits and our wages and work hours and things like that.
Gotcha. Thanks for sharing your experience, Pat. We're just about out of time. Kate, what are you watching for as we hopefully soon emerge from the pandemic? What are the next things, just briefly, you're watching for in organized labor?
Is that for me?
For you, Kate, yeah.
Yeah. I think Pat's in the building trades, by the way, which has a different employment structure. I think what we're looking for, first of all, is how labor responds to the pandemic. The labor movement is a very diverse movement. They're ranging from the building trades, I think Pat is into, the unions that are filled with immigrant members and members of color. The real challenge for the labor movement is the need to organize more members. And I think that they need to focus more on organizing and less on politics. They need to put their resources into organizing. They need to really take on the challenge of racism in this country and the divisions within the racial divisions in this country.
Thanks to our guest, Kate Brodfenbrenner, Senior Lecturer and Director of Labor Education Research at Cornell University, with us today talking about how labor unions have fared during the pandemic. As Wisconsin goes through a second winter of COVID-19, scientists know more about the virus, but the path of the pandemic remains uncertain. This month saw the most people hospitalized with COVID in the state since the beginning of the pandemic. Vaccines were supposed to prevent that, but reluctance to take them and an ever-changing virus have prolonged the pandemic longer than nearly anyone expected. Shemaine Mills reports.
In October, Janine Combs went to the emergency room with her husband Douglas, who was having chest pain. Nearly an hour later, he was seen by a doctor. It would be 3 hours before he was admitted. The couple were told the Rock County Hospital was treating a lot of COVID-19 patients, and there weren't any beds immediately available.
It was absolutely heartbreaking watching him, you know, his face obviously in pain and being frustrated because he's not, you know, taking precedence over others who did not look that ill at all.
Combs survived, but like others, he was affected by COVID, even though he never had the disease. Today, there are nearly twice as many hospitalized with COVID in Wisconsin as there were when Combs had his heart trouble. The Omicron variant of the virus is thought to be 4 times as transmissible as Delta, and Delta was twice as contagious as the virus's original strain. This month, Wisconsin repeatedly broke records for the most new infections per day. Many of those infections will turn out to be mild. But not all. For some Wisconsinites, it's created a sense of despair about the pandemic. Will it ever end?
If you plan to travel with liquid gels or aerosols in your carry-on bag, remember 311.
Over the holidays, thousands of airport travelers found themselves stranded or delayed when flights were canceled because of sick staff. More than 3.5 million Wisconsinites have gotten vaccinated against COVID. The busy holiday travel season was a sign that some people were back in pre-pandemic routines.
We appreciate your cooperation with the federal mask mandate. Once again, welcome aboard. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas.
Shortly before the holidays, Tony Barcoot of Fitchburg was having her 5-year-old daughter tested because she didn't feel well.
I think this year people are a slightly bit more relaxed, I think, because we all know, I think at some point we're probably going to end up getting it. So I feel like it's a little bit more relaxed this year than last year, but that's just me.
Barcoot is vaccinated. Others, like Jeffrey Horn, don't plan to get a shot. He's relying on natural immunity after getting a mild case of COVID in October of 2020.
I didn't take any ivermectin or hydrochloroquine. I just mean the kinds of things that they would tell you to do if you had a bad case of the flu. Keep yourself hydrated. I did take some vitamins, over-the-counter vitamins. I took a lot of rest.
Doctors warn that natural immunity is likely to wear off in a couple months and may not protect against new variants of the virus. Horn also doesn't go along with another piece of medical advice. He says he won't wear a mask. On a cold winter night, Horn was among those who packed a rural town hall to talk about Dane County's mask requirement. Supervisor Jeff Weigen said he wanted people to be able to publicly share how the indoor mask mandate has affected families, schools, and businesses.
COVID is real, and many of us have been impacted by it. All of us have been impacted by it. Some of us have gotten it. Some of our family members might have passed away. This is a real thing. But I'm not going to live in fear by a virus.
Amen. But with hospitals full and staff drained, Health Secretary Karen Timberlake says everyone who may need medical care is at risk. Not only those ill with COVID-19, but people like Douglas Combs who needed emergency attention.
The risk to our communities has never been more dire.
January showed us the pandemic's not over. In some ways, it was the worst month we've had. Officials say it's still too soon to tell whether the latest wave has peaked, and the last 2 years have shown just how hard it can be to predict what will happen next. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, ballot drop boxes made a lot of news in the 2020 elections, and there's a back-and-forth dispute in Wisconsin courts for our February election. We learn about the latest from the courts and the state legislature. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.